listening to KDNK's public affairs program For Land's Sake. I'm your host, Bill Kite. Today our guest is Bo Persico.
Persico.
There we go. I knew I was going to mess that one up.
That's okay.
And welcome to Land's Sake, Bo.
Yes.
You're a Colorado Mountain College professor teaching environmental ethics. And before we delve into that, what the heck does environmental ethics, how do you get the background to be able to do what you're doing? Give us a little bit of history about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a philosophy course in ethics, but extended to the environment. And what's fascinating is that it's also a kind of activism course where we're looking at how do we make things change? What is it that is effective when we try to impact the political arena and also the economic sphere and make something happen for nature?
When I hear the words environmental ethics, it kind of makes me think, okay, I'm going to look this up because I think I know what it is, but I look it up on the internet and I get an academic site with a 61-page synopsis with a definition out there in academia, and I want to bring this down to beans and potatoes here so anybody listening can understand what we're talking about because there's so much at stake here.
Yes.
We're talking about Mother Earth here and how we're supposed to treat Mother Earth, and that doesn't always happen. So basically, define it if you can and why it's so important to you personally.
Well, I came out of an activist background in other realms, like the Vietnam War activism. I was in the civil rights movement. So I look at it as how do we make change? How do we do something to change society, to change the world so that we could keep the world rather than lose it?
Very good. Yeah, that's kind of important, isn't it? You know, the Earth's biosphere and ecological integrity are really threatened, and they're being threatened more and more every day, and we're losing the battle at an ever-increasing rate. I hate to be pessimistic. I'm a romantic realist, and I'm getting to the realism part here, folks. People elected to high positions in our country don't get it and are reversing decades of environmental protection that you and I saw happen at great cost. American public, through their Congress, passed these laws to protect Mother Earth. So what keeps you from despairing of our future with all the things happening like they are?
Well, I call myself a hopeful pessimist.
Okay.
Because I too have a concern like you do about what's happening. And sometimes it's overwhelming because there doesn't seem to be a way that we're going to pull out of this downward spiral, you know.
And it doesn't make any sense, does it?
No. And then when you look at, you know, what's arrayed against the effort and what it takes to get international efforts, let alone just our own local efforts to keep going, you know, and for people to make a difference. I'm focused on specifics. I like to bring articles in to each class that tell us what's actually at stake, what's actually happening, what is the good news in terms of programs that are working. There's a book called Drawdown by Hawken that gives us a picture of all the positive efforts that are happening all over the world. So it's not all dark. Some of it is light.
And Paul wrote a book called Natural Capitalism, too, didn't he?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah. So there's some good material out there for people that are really interested in pursuing this, isn't there?
Yes.
So Aldo Leopold is a lot of Forest Service people's hero. And I say that as a retired Forest Service person, but he's white. You know, he's an old man. He represents what everybody at that period of time in the period that he lived, of course, that's the way things were. And they gave us a lot of what today is environmental ethics, I feel, based upon his land ethic that he came up with, Aldo Leopold. And he made a sort of a come-to-Jesus moment there when he killed that wolf, looked into the eye of that wolf and saw life fading. So he had a major life event to get where he's at. How can we explain to people how his philosophy, his writings, and he himself is still relevant in the time we live in?
I ask people to look into their own experience with nature. And of course, we live in an area where people have lots of experience in nature to really capture that sense like he did, you know, right. The lyricism, the beauty, the continuity of nature, and how we can continue to be part of that and promote that, and to give lots of specifics to this so that people actually see it happening in conservation efforts where we do set aside certain land for open space and for wilderness, and where we protect those when they're under attack as they are now.
And we thought we had protected them.
Yeah, we did.
just by an act of Congress, by passing them as national monuments or our national parks. In the case of many of them, it was by presidential executive order. So, but they were protected, and we thought they were protected for as long as we lived, and we see them assaulted once again. So Aldo and people like him at the time they lived stood for something themselves by their writings, by their lives, by their involvement in the body politic. Unfortunately, today, a lot of people are turned off by government and politics when politics is life, folks. Let's get real here. And if you're not going to make a difference in life, in the life you live and your job, if you don't have ethics at all, then I don't know what to tell you. Because to me, ethics is the way you should live, the way you should act, the way you should treat other people. Am I off base there?
No, I think that's very true. In a practical sense, I think it is possible for us to reach out to people in terms of their own enlightened self-interest, to say there's going to be a benefit financially if we take care of nature. We're going to have health benefits if we keep our air clean, keep our water clean, actually promote the proper use of the land. All of these can have a connection with people when we do it right.
I think that's what it's about, Bo, is connection. I think so many people today are disconnected from Mother Earth, from with their electronic devices and whatnot. But we live in a place where people—that's not the case. That everybody that I know is always trying to be more in shape and get out in the mountains and enjoy it more because we live in such a beautiful place. I think we're bordering here on the spiritual in terms of sort of, to me, the salt of the earth. People I know that I have relationships with, the ones that are working hard and doing the job that serves all of us out there. Really, I want them to look at the earth and how they respect it and how they live their life today and how they can get involved. So how can the average person listening here get involved? You teach a CMC class. I'd like to find out about that first. And then how can the person listening out there who's upset about some of the things we are and who want to make a difference, how can they get involved?
Well, you're right. We do have environmental science courses coming up. We do have environmental ethics that we teach at regular intervals at CMC, actually, I think, twice a year. And there are opportunities to be involved in the sustainability program. But beyond that, I think what's really vital is that we tap into the experiences that people are having when they go out and help with trail maintenance, or when they go out and do cleanup, or when they go out and offer a volunteer effort with the national parks or with wilderness. All of those contribute, I think, to people's investment in protection and in stewardship, as we call it. You mentioned the spiritual angle of that. We always start with that, you know, that there is this tradition of stewardship of caring for and protecting the natural world.
And some of us who are poets and storytellers and writers look to seasoned elders and veterans like Gary Snyder. And I think, though, in looking at his work, his poetry, and his nonfiction, that bioregionalism is not really going to save us. What is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's good to keep the poets and keep the artists and keep the storytellers and the filmmakers, because they really do at their best enlighten us, inspire us, and we need that drive right now. We need a lot of energy behind our effort because of what we're up against.
Absolutely. So, who is a I don't want to use the word hero, but who's the person that stands out in your mind like Gary Snyder does in mine of someone to read or to emulate or look up to in a leadership position?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we have leaders in the movement. For instance, one that I'm interested in right now is Frederick Rich, who wrote a book called Getting to Green. The reason I mention him is because he has he has one leg in the conservative side and one leg in the liberal side, and he's trying to say there are ways that we actually have worked together in the past and that we are working together, and let's build on that rather than become so polarized and so much into conflict that we don't see where we can actually accomplish something.
Right. And if I remember correctly, he served under one president, didn't he?
Yes.
And he's written a few books, and he also, there's a movie that came out that I enjoyed that he made, a video.
Yeah.
So he's quite active himself.
Right.
And I respect his writings. You know, the take on trying to get folks, average person on the street, to have a voice. What's your take on how to find one's voice for people listening, whether they be a student or an older elder or whoever they might be?
You know, you mentioned Gary Snyder, you mentioned, Aldo Leopold, and there's a little bit of that in a lot of people.
Right.
And I try to call that out as much as possible, you know, to encourage writing, to encourage some kind of witnessing. I make my class members write a letter to a legislator or to any other entity where there's going to be a decision made to become active in that way and to also really put some expression into that.
What's your favorite stories, or really what makes you tick to want to teach? What inspires you?
That's a beautiful question. I had two uncles who were teachers and who were filled with excitement about students and had students in their homes and promoted their efforts and who were really inspiring in their fresh ways of teaching. And one of them especially was a dean at a community college. So I kind of feel like I'm carrying out that mission now that I've lost those uncles.
That's hard when you lose people that were your mentors, isn't it? It really is. You know, you used a word earlier that I think can mean a lot of different things to different people, and that's sustainability. It's a popular buzzword. Is it more than that to you? And if it can mean anything, how come there's so many different ways of looking at it by so many different people?
Yeah, we're always, I think, at risk when we use vague words and don't tie them to something specific. That's why I like it when there's a particular effort by a company or a particular effort by a college or university to have long-term plans that have to do with reducing emissions, increasing recycle and reuse, and making sure there's composting, addressing the hidden curriculum, as we call it. What are we actually modeling for people? Then I think we're doing something that the word sustainability can actually connect with.
Tell me a little bit about your class. I used to teach at CMC as an adjunct faculty, and I enjoyed the fact that there were students that were in high school and there were students who were retired just taking it just because they wanted to learn something. What's your makeup class look like, the makeup of it?
Yeah, the environmental ethics course especially has drawn what are called the traditional students, the younger ones, but also the non-traditional ones, the ones that are coming to us after having had some life experience, some career experience or jobs. And a lot of them bring an awareness that is keen, you know, from those encounters out in the real world. And so it's a marvelous mix when we get that. And we almost always have that in the environmental ethics course.
So suppose you want a student to really get excited or passionate about what you're teaching, and you see that light bulb come on. Where do you go from there with that student?
Yeah, I think part of it is to look for where they can take that in terms of career direction. I had have had several students that have gotten involved in solar installations that are interested in wind turbines, or that get into the political side of this and do something really worthwhile, either on the local level or on the state and federal level.
Are there other classes like this that you know of? I this is the first time I've heard of a class, environmental ethics. Have I just been like Rip Van Winkle asleep? Or,
you know, this is, to me, one of the fun things about environmental ethics is that it's actually the rebel course. It was a kind of reaction against traditional ethics, which only were from a human perspective, rather than looking at the whole ecosystem, looking at animals, looking at plants, looking at the landscape. This was a novel and revolutionary way to address ethics, and it is a relatively recent field.
There's one book that was written that developed some of the principles that we're talking about here called Deep Ecology.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that, your experience with that book?
Yeah, I think part of Deep Ecology was to say there are ways that we transform ourselves as well as transform our approach to nature when we take it to heart. And I'm more of what's called a consequentialist. I like to see consequences. I like to see action and outcome. You know,
right,
so that
exactly.
That's really what this can do if we commit ourselves through Deep Ecology or through any of these inspiring approaches to do the hard work and stay with it.
So what we're talking about here, too, is respect for not just human beings and their effect on the land, but for the land itself and the inhabitants of the land, for the landscapes, for the whole package.
Yeah.
Aren't we?
That's right.
So it's a holistic way of looking at life. And when you do that, there's some rewards, aren't there?
I think so. The other thing is that we've had such a narrow focus on our own experience as humans, our consciousness, our intelligence, our capacity for caring or empathy. And we're learning that that's a dimension of many, many animals' lives. There are very intelligent animals. There are animals that have a lot to teach us. And the more that we come to see nature as continuous with us and as having bright spots that we need to be enlightened by, you know.
Right.
I think we start to treat nature as part of us rather than alien in some fashion.
And I the enlightenment, it seems like a lot of people have an understanding that it happens and you achieve it. You get your diploma and you can keep going with your life. But to me, enlightenment comes when you get those aha moments in nature, where you're being spoken to by the land. The land is telling you, look at me. You're reading the landscape is what you're doing. That kind of one-on-one experience can't be duplicated, can it?
Yes, I think that when I look into the landscape, I look into myself, you know, as well. And and nature reflects something back to me about who I am. And it's usually very humbling.
Isn't it? That's for sure. I can attest to that, definitely. That's a really good idea there that just came from that voice in the background. sacred places. I've had some experience with that. I think, to me, the protection of those places so that indigenous people can go back and communicate with the land in the way their ancestors did is a calling that I was able to answer. It wasn't something I asked for. I didn't apply for. But it came from being so involved with the land and the landscape that I couldn't avoid asking, where are the people who once lived here?
Oh, that's such a beautiful perspective, isn't it? To try to recapture that sense of wonder and awe about the people that came before us on this continent and all continents, you know, and how they were part of nature and how we can honor their legacy, in a sense, their spiritual legacy, by honoring the land and especially by really using the sacred places to inspire us to keep us humble about what we're doing in nature.
Absolutely. And I think when you present yourself to the elders when you're working with them, that you really care about the things that they care about on that land and how you want to help preserve it. And you make mistakes, but you're another human being relating to another human being, and life's only about timing and relationships. So you build those relationships, you understand then what sacred means, and you understand why that you can be a part of helping them worship at that place and have it still be there for them to do that?
My training has been in mindfulness and meditation, and I truly believe that we can be present in each moment in each place fully. That it doesn't have to be just when I'm at Delegate Arch or Landscape Arch or out at the Upheaval Dome. I can be wherever I am and honor the natural world around me and within me.
And that's words there from Bo Perseco. He's here from CMC class. He teaches about ethics, environmental ethics, and really pleased to have you as our guest today, Bo.
Been a pleasure.
This is Bill Kite. You're listening to For Land's Sake at every second Tuesday of the month. So I'll see you again December the 12th at 4:30. And until then, whatever you do to Mother Nature, be sure you do it for land's sake.